Chapter 2. Dressed for dinner in her Liberty silk smock, her long narrow feet tamed into plain kid pumps, Edith thought for ways of delaying the moment at which she would be forced to descend into the dining room and take her first meal in public. She even wrote a few paragraphs of Beneath the Visiting Moon, then on rereading them realised that she had used the same device in The Stone and the Star and crossed them out. And in crossing them out, understood exactly where she would have to go when she started again. Thus, slightly reassured with tomorrow's work tentatively programmed, she closed the folder, took up her bag and her key, and walked resolutely out of the room. From the same not-too-distant point along the corridor, she could hear the radio again, and although bath water, and as she went towards the stairs, there seemed to be a sudden emanation of a rosy scent, signalling the sort of preparation made by someone with a proper sense of her own presence. The woman with the dog, thought Edith. She will emerge rather late, in some stunning creation, flat-stomached and disdainful, the dog under her arm. I must try and talk to her. There will, she thought painfully, be nothing else to do after dinner. Downstairs all was deserted, and she realised that she was too early. The only sound came from the bar, where subdued masculine conversation, unbroken by laughter or conviviality, was in progress. She would have liked a gin and tonic, but could not quite make the effort. She sat down at a small table in the salon and picked up a crumpled copy of the Gazette de Lausanne, which someone had left. Curious that it had not been cleared away, she thought. The housekeeping here seems so very careful. But at that moment, the bulldog-faced lady, whom she must remember to address properly, if she were ever called upon to address her at all, appeared in the doorway wearing an all-purpose black dress and having changed her blue veil with the bows for a black one with a few slightly precarious sequins, raised her stick and said, "Ah!" Edith held up the Gazette de Lausanne with an inquiring smile. Madame de Bonneuil nodded and began rocking her way through the thicket of unoccupied chairs and tables. Edith rose to meet her, but Madame de Bonneville made surprisingly rapid progress, and Edith was stalled at the next table but two. "Merci," said Madame de Bonneville, raising her stick again. "Je vous en prie," said Edith, and returned to her chair. They were the first words she had spoken since her arrival. Leaning back and closing her eyes briefly, she allowed her dread of the evening before her to come to the surface. In any event, meals in public were not to her taste, even when she was accompanied. She remembered with a slight shudder the last meal she had had before leaving England. Her agent, Harold Webb, had taken her out to lunch. He had clearly meant to raise her spirits, but assured her of his confidence in her. Had even told her that he intended to negotiate a high advance for her next book. "This other business will blow away," he had said, lighting an uncustomary cigar. A mild, scholarly man who looked like a country doctor, he disliked the more sociable aspects of his calling, but had nevertheless booked a table in a cathedral-like restaurant, where the patrons cowered in a worship before the marvels to be set front of them, and had gamely tackled the intricacy coiled fillet of fish, which had seemed to be the simplest item on the menu. Edith regretted the Perrier water, which always gave her wind, stared moodily into the distance. Conversation was not easy. "I like the idea of the new one," said Harold, after a longish pause, "although I have to tell you that the romantic market is beginning to change. It's sex for the young women executives now, the cosmopolitan reader, the girl with the executive briefcase." Receiving no response, he made play with the tiny fan of fretted carrot placed on the side plate, and having dealt with that, returned to the attack. "What does she take with her on that business trip to Brussels?"
"Glasgow," amended Edith.
"What? Oh, well, probably, but anyway, she wants something to reassure her that being liberated is fun. She wants something to flatter her ego when she's spending a lonely night in a hotel. She wants something to reflect her lifestyle."
"Harold," said Edith, "I simply do not know anyone who has a lifestyle. What does it mean? It implies that everything you own was bought at exactly the same time, about 5 years ago, at the most. And anyway, if she's all that liberated, why doesn't she go down to the bar and pick someone up? I'm sure it's entirely possible. It's just that most women don't do it. And why don't they do it? She asked with a sudden return of assurance. It's because they prefer the old myth when it comes to the crunch. They want to believe that they are going to be discovered, looking their best, behind closed doors, just when they thought that all was lost, by a man who has battled across continents, abandoning whatever he may have had in his tray, to reclaim them. Ah, if only it was true, she said, breathing hard and spearing a slice of kiwi fruit which remained suspended on her fork as she bent her head and thought this one out. She really does look remarkable, Bloomsbury, thought Harold, viewing the hollow cheeks and the pursed lips. Well, my dear, you know best, he said, not wishing to upset her any more than she'd already been upset by that other business. I just thought that. And what is the most potent myth of all? She went on in a slightly ringing tone that caused him to make a discreet sigh to the waiter for the bill. The tortoise and the hare, she pronounced. People love this one, especially women. Now, you will notice, Harold, that in my books, it is the mouse-like, unassuming girl who gets the hero, whilst the scornful temptress with whom he has had a stormy affair retreats baffled from the fray, never to return. The tortoise wins every time. This is a lie, of course, she said pleasantly, with an authority, the kiwi fruit slipping back unnoticed onto her plate. In real life, of course, it is the hare who wins every time. Look around you. And in any case, it is my contention that Aesop was writing for the tortoise market. Axiomatically, she cried, her voice rising with enthusiasm, hares have no time to read. They are too busy winning the game. The propaganda goes all the other way, but only because it is a tortoise who is in need of consolation. Like the meek who are going to inherit the earth, she added, with a brief smile. After a pause, she addressed herself to what was left on her plate, ate it in one dismissive mouthful, and leaned back, still lost in her argument. He reflected that she was not a professor's daughter for nothing, but that she could be relied upon to get back to work fairly soon. And that, after a break, she would probably come up with yet another modest but substantial seller. Of course, said Edith, landing chips of sugar-coloured like bath salts in her coffee, you could argue that the hare might be affected by the tortoise lobby's propaganda, might become more prudent, circumspect, slower in fact. But the hare is always convinced of his own superiority. He simply does not recognise the tortoise as a worthy adversary. That is why the hare wins, she concluded. In life, I mean, never in fiction. At least not in mine. The facts of life are too terrible to go into my kind of fiction, and my readers certainly do not want them there. You see, Harold, my readers are essentially virtuous, and as far as they are concerned, and as far as I am concerned, those multi-orgasmic girls with the executive briefcases can go elsewhere. They would be adequately catered for. There are hucksters in every marketplace. I see you're getting back to your old form, said Harold, counting out a quantity of notes. Thank you for lunch, Harold, Edith said in the busy street outside. The coming separation from his kindly and self-effacing concern struck her more forcibly now than he had done hitherto. He was the only person who could be trusted to get in touch with her once she had gone away. He was the only person, well, almost, who knew where she was going. He was, alas, not the only person who knew why she was going. She looked imploringly into his eyes, aware that he had paid far too much money for a meal that would leave him hungry in an hour's time. Her own appetite was gone, quite gone. It hardly mattered what she ate these days, since she no longer mattered to herself. But those lovely meals that she had cooked for David, those heroic fry-ups, those blowouts that he always seemed to require when he eventually got out of bed at such awkward times after midnight, sometimes leaving it to the last minute before he raced back to Holland Park through the silent streets. "I never get this stuff at home," he would say lovingly, spearing a chip and inserting it into the yolk of a fried egg. Anxious, in her nightgown, she would watch him, a saucepan of baked beans to hand. Judging the state of his appetite with the eye of an expert, she would take another dish and ladle it onto his plate, a quivering mound of egg custard. "Food fit for heroes," he would sigh contentedly, his lean, milky body forever resistant to the fattening effects of such diet. "Smashing," he would pronounce, leaning back, repleted. "Any tea going?" But as he drank his tea, she would notice him quicken, straightening, becoming more rapid and decisive in his movements. And when he passed his hands over his short, dark, red hair, she would know that the transition was in progress and that he would soon get dressed. Then she felt she knew less of him. All the business of cufflinks and watches belonged to his other life. This is what he did every morning whilst his wife called to the children who were going to be late. And finally, she felt she hardly knew him at all, although she watched from behind the curtain as he ran out to the car, hastily now, and roared off into the night. It always felt as if he had gone forever, but he had always come back. Sooner or later, he had come back. It had seemed to her that the daylight hours were spent simply waiting for him, and yet there were five novels, of some length, there to prove that she had not spent her time gazing out of the window like the Lady of Shalott. It was, she recognised, a tortoise existence, despite the industry. That was why she wrote for tortoises like herself. "But now I am reduced to pure tortoisedom," she thought, opening her eyes and gazing fearfully around the still deserted salon. But the appearance of a waiter in the doorway with a napkin over his arm gave her an access of determination, if only to get the meal over. For now she wanted to be alone in her room so as to think. Those pills must have worn off, she thought, feeling rather dizzy as she stood up, her throat aching with a suppressed yawn. This is when character tells, as father would say, and she urged herself onwards to the dining room, prepared to eat because it was good for her, and to remain in equable frame of mind for as long as possible. The dining room was in fact very pleasant, with its long windows overlooking the garden, now quite black, and the small bunches of rather homely flowers on each spotless white tablecloth. It was also deserted. A table in the corner was occupied by four men in grey suits who kept up the same absorbed monotone that she had already located in the bar. Madame de Bonneuil, chewing steadily and without expression, had a curious way of taking her wine, in large gulps, as if rinsing her mouth out, and between courses would sit with her hands on the table, waiting for more. Edith could just see embedded in her brownish fingers small rings, one crested, but with the indentation worn away. The woman with the dog, a crêpe de chine blouse hanging rather gauntly from her long neck and narrow shoulders, proved to be something of a disappointment, for she had not made the entrance that Edith had mentally written for her and was hunched in her seat, rather dishevelled around the hair at an adjacent table, with the impassive boy in the white jacket standing like a footman behind her chair. Kiki snuffled from beside her and was picked up from time to time and pressed to his mistress's face, a face, Edith noticed, which now gave minute hints of ultimate disintegration. With Kiki now on her lap, the woman, wavering fork, used more for flourishing than for eating, contrived to create an impression of food being consumed, although Edith could see quite a lot of it sliding down towards the tablecloth. Somehow it never quite fell, for Kiki would jump up and retrieve it, rather like a tainted seal. Edith had the impression that Kiki was, in more ways than one, invaluable. The impassive boy's attendant seemed to be entirely purposeless until, at a nod from the head waiter, he leaned forward to remove the half-finished bottle of fricati and carry it. with a firm and uncompromising step to a remote corner of the room. Seconds later, with the same firm and uncompromising step, he returned with a large ice cream which he set before her and resumed his position behind her chair. The woman with the dog rolled her fine, erratic eye in Edith's direction, gave a complicated and sophisticated grimace, and returned her attention to her plate. Theatrical, thought Edith, one of those extremely tall dancers who make a go of it in a foreign cabaret and then retire. But why here? She was aware that the food was hot and excellent, and that much to her surprise she was enjoying it, and reviving minute by minute under its influence. Slightly more alert by now, she looked round the table, but there was little to see. The grey men were still absorbed in their conversation. Two young couples from the town, obviously having a night out and had been placed near the window, overlooking the invisible garden. A plump elderly man, who was, in fact, Monsieur Hubert, had decided to keep an eye on things whilst having his dinner, thus combining his two favourite occupations. Although finding almost everything in his taste, Mr. Hubert did not neglect to summon nearly all the waiters to his table, where they were subjected to twinkling abominations and then speeded on their way. Out of season, reflected Edith, and at the beginning of the show, the woman with the dog got up, stumbled, her napkin falling to the floor. Then, picking up Kiki, she turned a superb stare on to the boy in the white jacket, who stepped forward and, taking a deep breath, prepared to make a dignified exit. Madame de Bonneuil, her hands on the table, gave a loud belch. Monsieur Hubert closed his eyes briefly. Edith was interested to see, but when he opened them, his face creased into an expression of seraphic joy. Following his gaze, she saw the occasion for this. Across the room, in midnight blue lace, small diamonds sparkling in her ears, the glamorous lady, who had demanded tea for her daughter, stood hesitantly in the doorway. Then, having assured herself that her presence had been noted, and would indeed be welcome, she advanced graciously to her table. Her daughter, in a sleeveless black dress, followed after, smiling to left and right, as if to gather up the bouquets. "This I must see," thought Edith, pouring herself another glass of water. She was already aware of the powerful and undiagnosed feeling towards these two. Curiosity, envy, delight, attraction, and fear. The fear she always felt in the presence of strong personalities. And they were undoubtedly strong. There was no doubt of that, although their presence here was problematic. They seemed destined for better things. This was apparent in the way the waiter appeared from all sides to settle them in their chairs. Menus were flourished, laughing remarks exchanged. The women with the dog, quite eclipsed by this activity, looked back at them with another complicated expression on her face. Edith noticed that although she had already encountered the two women on her way out, they had quite ignored her. Again, a tiny thrill of fear whispered at the back of her mind. But they were worth watching. They were veritable concentrations of energy as well as charm. And not only were they charming to look at, they had glorious appetites to match. Talking busily to each other, knives and forks flashed as they ate their way enthusiastically through four courses. At the same time, plans were being drawn up for the following time. "What time did you order the car?" Edith could hear. "And remind me to take those shoes back, Mummy." Then, like many greedy women, they sat back facetiously, as if the food had scarcely come to notice. Butter wouldn't melt, thought Edith. Yet she was forced to follow them out. A humble and often stalled attendant in their rosy and perfumed wake. For this, she now realised, was the source of the scent she had smelt in the corridor. And as they took their seats in the salon, she sat near them, as if to gain some bravery, some confidence from their utterly assured presence. Waiting for coffee to be brought, they surveyed their faces sternly in the mirrors of their respective compacts. Adjustments were made, lips gleamed anew, and the ash blonde lady lifted her head to smile at the elderly pianist, who had now returned with further selection from indeterminate sources. "Ah, Noël!" the ash blonde lady exclaimed indulgently, as the mild and conscientious sound arose. What a genius that boy was! That boy? Edith realised that ages would have to be revised at once again. But before she could do this, she saw the daughter rise to her feet, smooth her black dress down over her abundant hips, and advance in her direction. Her rather large, flushed, blonde face was lowered quizzically towards Edith, and she said, "Mummy was wondering if you'd like to join us for coffee." And of course, it was a deliverance. Deliverance from the evening that lay ahead, and Edith rose joyfully to her feet, followed the daughter, bowed her head slightly to the mother, and said, "How kind of you. My name is Edith Hope, and I arrived today. I am Mrs. Pusey," said the lady, "Iris Pusey. How do you do? Have you been here? And this is my daughter, Jennifer." They sat down, smiling at each other expectantly. Coffee arrived. Mrs. Pusey leaned forward and took a cup. "I said to Jennifer to go and ask that lady to join us. I hate to see anyone on their own, especially in the evening." She settled back in her chair. Edith smiled again. "I said she has such sad eyes."